Lord Bridgman Rule 3. The detailed plans for the 34 exercise would, of course, be well documented, and we needn't go into them in any detail. But can you tell me anything about Lindsay's reaction to the directives which he personally received?
Oh, yes, I can. You see, to start with, the exercise involved the mobile force, commanded by George Lindsay, assembling somewhere near Gloucester and advancing southwards or southeastwards until they got to the Kennet-Avon Canal, where they were to cross the canal and attack the enemy, then withdraw. Now, this was expressed as a subsidiary operation to a bigger operation which was supposed to be taking place, in theory, immediately afterwards. George's instructions, the operation instructions on which he was told to issue his order, were that they were to make this raid, if you like. But in doing so...
This is the second one, is it?
No, the first.
The first one.
In doing so, they were to take care not to put their force too much at risk, as it might be wanted for another operation later on. When George told me that, I said, well, this is rather like a trainer giving his riding orders to a jockey and saying, you're going to ride this horse in the Derby, and of course I want you to win it, but you must remember that I also want you to win the later, which follows. Well, that, first of all, was a restriction. This applies to all the plans. The next restriction was that there was nothing in the plan to provide for a suitable air superiority being obtained before the tanks went forward. But no one but a lunatic would ever dream of carrying out an operation of that sort if the armor below was still at risk of the air. It's the business of the airmen to get air superiority. That's the second restriction. Then on this, unfortunately, George had to put up a plan. He put up one plan, and this was turned down.
Why?
Because Jock Stewart wanted to make it more difficult. He then put up another plan. And at this point, a lot of the differences of opinion came out with Hobart. They arose chiefly because George wanted to split the units of the tank brigade at the start of the exercise on a front wider than 8 miles. He also wanted to use the light tank battalion for something that Hobart didn't want. And so this plan had to be altered, because George had made it quite plain to Hobart that the tanks were the important things, and he was going to do everything he possibly could to make the tank part of the operation a success. That forced George to put up a third alternative. I don't think he'd have put it up, in fact I know he wouldn't, except as an act of desperation to put up something which Jock Stewart would agree to. And so he went into the battle on a plan which he's written down was against all his previous military thought. The result of that was that on a cold September morning, the tanks had been umpired so that they lost a great part of their efficiency through air bombing, were held prisoners by the 16th Lancers outside Hungerford. And that was that.
Mm. Now, during the operation, you, of course, were still with 7th Infantry Brigade. Could you tell me a little more detail about the 7th Infantry Brigade's participation and any highlights of the exercise as it unfolded?
Not very much. You see, we were sent off in buses. We got down near Hungerford. We did our task in protecting the tanks in Savanac Forest. And the reason why the tanks suffered was not because we hadn't protected them, but because air bombing was ordered by the umpire to destroy them. My main recollection of that time was waiting about and hearing the news of all the nonsense is going on, seeing all the reporters in the bar at Hungerford talking and drinking, with nothing that we could do, because our movements, you see, depended on the armour. There it was. It was not for us to fight the battle, it was for us to protect the armour. That wasn't a very exciting thing, and we were there at the places where we wanted to be.
I think it's fair to say that, on the whole, the judgment of the Army staff on the results of this exercise was that the mobile force had been a failure. How did those of you who were actually a part of its operations feel about it at the time? Did you feel it had been a failure?
No. We felt we'd been taken for a ride in a big way. And I think that anybody who knew anything about it felt the same way. I know that after that, one of the things I did was to go and see the chap in the War Office that I'd been working with, who was a chap who was afterwards well known, General Dorman Smith, who was actually a close friend of mine, to find out if they were, if he and Colonel MacCready, who was his boss, the War Office, were under any illusions. They were not. So no thinking person who knew anything about it ever took any other view except that the armour had been deliberately taken for a ride.
Well, that on the face of it would seem to throw a heavy burden of responsibility on Bernard Stewart. The thing which I wonder is what his motives could have been.
It's anybody's guess. You see, one was in a period then when there was far more support for the traditional infantry and cavalry in higher places than there ever was for the development of armour. You've got to remember that nothing had been done since the First War to put into practice the lessons of Cambrai. You've got to think of the people who were at the head of the army then, Devereux, Knox, Gaythorn, Hardy people. You've got to remember that the cavalry lobby was extremely strong. If you like to read the Hansard of the Army estimates of 1934, you'll see that Duff Cooper committed himself to it. Then you think of Jock himself. I don't know how much you studied him.
Very little.
But he was a man who was intellectually several laps ahead of any of the people of his own rank. And a great many people thought that it was a great pity that he did not become CIGS. Not quite sure how much of a pity it was. But amongst his other qualities was a very highly overdeveloped sense of humour. It wasn't always applied at the right place. Now, did Jock know at the time when he set the exercise that he was not going to become CIGS? If so, did he act like Samson and pull down the pillars of the temple? That particular chap could perfectly well have done it. Next year, you see, he was chief umpire at the manoeuvres. Devereux and Gaythorn Hardy were commanding each side, which meant that he'd been passed by. There's an explanation. It's a possible one. But I don't pretend that I've ever been able to sort out Jock's motives to my own satisfaction. I do say that I'm quite certain that it was his action. Nor do I know whether he ever realized what the consequences of doing that were going to be. Mm. I'm fairly certain he didn't.
Since we shall have to speculate about what those motives might have been, can we turn our attention to somewhat more practical considerations? Did the exercise itself prove to be of any practical use in developing the more closely cooperation between tanks and infantry, which had been one of its objectives?
Oh, yes. It was a start, you see. Everybody knew that it could work. Those who were in the know knew that it could be made to work extremely well. We'd learned certain lessons. Most of them were fairly low-level ones. And if we'd all been there next year and had been given the green light, we could have got on with them.
What lessons did you learn?
Well, I mean about the administrative vehicles, the signals, how much time the infantry wanted to do what the tanks wanted, exactly what the tanks did want in the way of protecting their harbours, and those sort of things. Mm. Nothing big, because the big idea was all right.
Yeah.
I think probably one of the main results, evil results, was that because of this, no money was available for about 2 years to promote the further experiments, still less to produce the design of tank.
Mm.
Then on top of that, you got something which was not connected with it, but is related to it. That is Horbelicia's decision to employ Little Hart as a consultant, as a sort of alternative to the official advice he got.
Mm.
That, in its turn, produced a very good reason for the Treasury never to produce any money. Then again, you see, this resulted in the disappearance of George Lindsay. He was sent to command the presidency in Assam district, as Bernie Fuller had been sent to command at Bombay at an earlier stage. It was said that he was sent there because he was top of the list and he had to go. And Sir Roger Montgomery once told me that. And I thought, like the Duke of Wellington, that if you could believe that, you could believe anything. Things might have been rescued if Herbert had been left in command of the field. But he wasn't, because he was sent off to command a division in Egypt, where he certainly carried on certain experiments. But he left no one at the helm of armoured thinking.
Could I put one other rather more lowly levelled question to you again about the lessons of the 34 exercise? Apart from the 7th Infantry Brigade and the Tank Brigade, there was a Hussars regiment as part of the mobile force.
Yes.
Did any information come out of the exercise as regards the place of horse cavalry within an integrated force?
Well, they weren't
of this
horse cavalry, they were armoured cars.
Oh, I see.
You see the...
Which Hussars was it?
11th Hussars.
Oh, it was the 11th, of course. They had been mechanised back in
28. Well, you see, the 11th were armoured cars, and there was no particular lesson came out. The armoured cars were doing the sort of things you expected armoured cars to do. The exercise wasn't particularly designed to test the armoured cars, but they had to be there because a mobile force of that sort would not have been complete without them.
Yes.
The horse cavalry, the 16th Lancers under George Clark, were on the other side.
Mm.
So that, no, you could not have had a horse in the mobile division.
No, I should have known
because
better.
The pace of the horse would have... not worked in with the pace you had to go.
Yes, I should have known better than to ask that question.
Well, no, there's the answer.